You're listening to Architecture Masters.
I'm Jennifer Dixon. I lead the architecture practice for ACOM in the region known as EMEA, which is Europe, Middle East, Africa and India.
Hello and welcome to Architecture Masters. Our guest this week is the architect Jennifer Dixon, architecture leader at the global architecture and engineering firm ACOM in Europe, the Middle East, India and Africa, where she leads a multinational team of over 500 architects. ACOM provides integrated design, consulting, construction and management services to a wide range of clients around the world. The firm traces its roots back to the 1920s in Kentucky as the Ashland Oil and Refining Company, from where the company grew into one of America's largest road construction firms, using the byproducts of oil refining to produce bitumen for the roads. The company went on to become one of the pioneering integrated construction, engineering, and architectural firms in the US. In the late 1980s, a change in corporate strategy led to the spin-off of the non-oil side of the business that would become ACOM. And in 1990, the company changed its name to the ACOM Technology Corporation, with the acronym standing for Architecture, Engineering, Consulting, Operations and Maintenance. ACOM became a publicly traded company in 2007 and now has annual revenues of over $18 billion and nearly 90,000 employees around the world. More recently, the firm acquired consulting engineers Faber-Maunsell and quantity surveyors Davis Langdon. Jennifer joined ACOM in 2013 to grow the organization's architecture business in Europe, the Middle East, India, and Africa, which was then relatively small, at least compared to the firm's architecture businesses in its other regions. Jennifer originally studied architecture at the Mackintosh School of Architecture in Glasgow and at the University of Westminster in London. She subsequently founded Dixon Hughes Architects with her partner David Hughes, with the practice later merging with Austin Smith Lord, where she worked extensively in London and the Middle East. I joined Jennifer in ACOM's London offices near Aldgate, where I started by asking about the origins of the architecture business within ACOM. A long history to the company in various kind of identities and various guises became ACOM the architecture's right at the front, but architecture, engineering, consulting, operations and maintenance. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Okay,
that's
so right. Big company.
But the A in ACOM definitely stands for architecture.
Right at the front.
That's the main point.
And I guess kind of vying as an architecture firm, 1,400 architects around the world. So big.
No, more.
Wow,
more.
Okay, I'm happy
to take. So we have somewhere between 1,600 and 1,700 practicing architects.
Okay.
But I think we worked out, although we can't do it empirically, that we probably have another 500 to 700 architecturally educated staff who are operating in non-practicing roles.
Right.
So we probably got an actual architect population of well over 2,000.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. And so things kind of vary a little bit, but one of the largest architecture firms in the world.
Yes,
then.
Absolutely. Up there in the top three or five, okay, or whichever way you want to measure it, if okay, numbers of architects are indeed a measure of anything important.
Okay. And then, it's not in the same way that people maybe talk about Richard Rogers or Norman Foster. It's not perhaps a household name in the same way as those companies. Maybe more kind of known in business circles, do you think, in terms of the... I'm just kind of interested in...
Well, it depends if we're talking about globally or in the EMEA region,
right,
because
okay,
I think there are some differences. In the Americas, as ACOM was being formed, businesses and practices were bought that were specifically architectural and
right,
for that purpose. What's distinct about ACOM in the EMEA region is that we don't have any significant legacy architectural practice brands,
right,
that
okay,
attack,
so
that are on,
yeah,
that, and there are one or two smaller ones, but they're not large scale or household names. So it's fundamentally an organically grown architectural business.
Right, outside of the US.
Outside of the US,
right,
yes.
Okay.
Yes. No, I think that's slightly different in Asia Pacific. Again, they've made one or two acquisitions, but in EMEA, okay. We're broadly an organically grown architectural practice of upwards of 500 architects, yes, at the moment.
Okay, and that's the team that you lead. So we're,
yes,
how many people in London? How many?
In London, probably around 70. In the UK, okay, and Ireland, around 120 altogether.
And then, I guess I was kind of interested in your route then into architecture. You studied at the MAC, the Macintosh School.
I studied
in Glasgow.
At the MAC and then at University of Westminster, then
okay.
PCL.
Okay.
My father was an architect, so I grew up in his practice. He was a sole practitioner with one or two employees,
okay,
in North London.
So Londoner by, you know, from, you're born in London.
I was born in London, but not to, okay, British parents. So I've been brought up as a tourist in London.
Right. Where are your parents from?
Australia and the Falkland Islands.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So my Falkland Island father, the only architect ever to have come out of the Falklands and who designed the 1982 Liberation Memorial.
Wow. Okay.
Set up practice in London in 1962. I don't think he ever worked for anybody else, virtually.
Okay.
And was a practice owner all his life. And I assumed that I would sort of follow that. And I started my own practice with my partner in 1992.
Okay. 1993. And that was Dixon Hughes.
Yeah.
Architects.
Yeah,
okay.
That's right.
And what sort of work were you doing then? Was that
just
kind of
exactly
similar?
Exactly the same sort of work as everybody does when they start,
okay,
a practice. We'd actually been extremely lucky. We'd both had sort of quite good experience after we'd both finished and qualified. And I worked for a couple of London practices, and then we both met at Spire Amiga Architects, which,
right,
no longer exists, but okay, so, you know, it's the classic thing.
Yeah.
Sort of met at an architectural practice.
Yeah.
But where we were extremely fortunate is that during the recession of the time in the early sort of late 80s, we both headed off to Southeast Asia and ended up working for several years in Bangkok for local developers on site, literally dragging buildings out,
right,
of the ground with our bare hand and you know, big schemes,
multiple towers on large scale.
Yeah,
stuff.
And I think that definitely, for me, definitely changed my view of the kind of scale that cities could be made at and that architects could participate in city making. And having studied with Doug Cleland at Westminster, which really sort of changed my focus again to the city scale, away from the building scale, to work on a whole city quarter and be there sort of in the dirt with 6,000 workers building it and, you know, checking rebar and designing stuff as you go, was a hugely formative experience for an architects in their late 20s as we were then. And, to go back to that part of the city of Bangkok now and see it totally absorbed into the city that you couldn't even recognise it as. And in those days, we were building a new city quarter in a bit of jungle and, you know, there were snakes outside the back door. And, no, there really were snakes outside the back door.
It's a different approach to wearing PPE and risk assessment on site, isn't it?
It really was. And you know, quite a few tragedies as well.
Yeah.
And the way that our industry has sort of become more sophisticated in the way that we, you know, look after the safety of people not only on site but our employees generally is what a transition in the 25 years since then.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely horrifying what we did
back then.
Yeah, absolutely horrifying. So we got that experience and then we came back to.
So that was fairly soon after your part three. Then you kind of off, and I mean it's interesting then kind of international parents and obviously a lot of your work now is leading kind of teams abroad. Is there obviously, I mean, there must be something about enjoying that travel and that some people are obviously kind of feel the need to stay at home and, you know, stay at home in their home country. But there's clearly a kind of push to the wider world there with Bangkok and then with certainly the work at ACOM.
I suppose that I've never really grown up with any geographic boundaries because, you know, I've definitely been brought up as a global citizen. My parents decided to bring me up in London by choice, not by happenstance, because they thought it was a good place to bring up children. I've done the same because I happen to agree with them. It's not that I didn't have a lot of choice, I've always been brought up to consider that the whole world is open for business for me. Yeah.
Excellent. We might come on to that then with kind of changes in Britain's approach to the world and things. But kind of interested then in kind of jumping around a bit, but back to Dixon Hughes. You spent sort of 20 years there. What was the? How long were you running there?
We started off like any young architect listening to this, exactly the same. We turned up on the plane on the 1st of October in 1993. I remember it vividly. Right. And we were going to start a practice and we both looked at each other and said, okay, what do we do now? And we literally started. Our first project was a Christmas card for a developer who had a portfolio of property, lovely properties. And we thought, what can we do to contract their interest? My partner did David Hughes did a measured drawing, a beautiful measured drawing of some of their listed buildings and made it into our Christmas card, and they paid us for it. That's the first thing we ever got paid for. And we were over 10 years, we did the classic things of starting with one or two small commissions. We were lucky enough to get a good mixture of not just sort of, we did some residential work, but we were lucky to get work with one or two sort of key and interested small developers who kind of like to work with a ambitious team. And I think the other thing that I think was very good for us is that we got a couple of opportunities with leisure retail rollout companies doing pub chains and restaurant chains sort of thing, which I have to say I would recommend to any practice. It may not seem, you know, it may not necessarily seem glamorous, but actually it's really interesting and you get a high turnover of work, which means you learn an awful lot about business.
Very quickly, business side.
You might put a Wagamama in a brand new building or a listed building or whatever, and you just learn the anatomy of buildings very, very quickly. And I think it's hugely formative.
Okay.
And I think, you know, rolling out projects for global clients and trying to get consistency, you know, in a portfolio rather than doing one-off projects for clients, I think is extremely interesting and particularly relevant in this global world. It's not about globalizing the product. It's actually getting enough consistency
within a brand,
but then being able to localize a product to suit its market. And that really fascinates me.
Right. So how long was starting the practice and it you sort of grew organically?
Organically to about, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8 or something, the normal thing.
Yeah.
We fitted out a generator building in King's Cross before the days that King's Cross was on the map and moved in there. But at the same time, had a couple of kids along the way, the normal things of juggling wildly.
When you say business partner, you mean partner. I mean, it's a strange term in architecture, the kind of partner term that...
My business partner was all my partner David Hughes.
Right. Okay.
we were doing all of those classic things, and really, I just assumed that we would just build our own practice and you know eventually become you know whatever we would become. I wasn't really looking forward very much, but then it would be 2003. I can't remember exactly what the financial conditions, but what I felt, and I think this is particularly relevant for people starting practices, two or three things sort of started to become clear. One was that starting a family practice, once you start to have more employees, the peaks and troughs of cash flow become really, really demanding if you're not sort of capitalized from somewhere, which... We weren't particularly, you know, we were just sort of, you know, we hadn't brought, you know, we didn't have much debt, but we didn't have any significant capital. And we'd never really thought about the idea of having to fund a business, because I suppose my model had been, my father is a sole practitioner, doing work and getting paid, but not really going down the route of doing larger projects and more employees. And so we found that the peaks and troughs of cash flow, even though we had very good support and advice, it's just the realities of it was really quite strong. It wasn't easy to borrow from the banks. The swings, the peaks and troughs got greater and greater. And at the same time, as our projects got bigger, the funders of projects, though they were very keen and happy to have our design work and get planning consent, they started to get rather cold feet when it came to the cold hard truth of building it, right. Detail and delivering it. So those two things together, made us feel rather, that it was quite those limits to growth and limits to progress, and we felt a little bit of a dead end in a way. It was just a struggle, and also having two small children never helps. So out of the blue, we were offered the opportunity to become the become the mainstay, to take our office into Austin Smith Lord and become the mainstay of their London practice, because a couple of partners had retired.
Quite a regional practice originally, were they?
They'd had a very strong, originally though, they were a very strong London practice, founded by Annette and Mike Austin Smith, who were, I have to say, were absolutely stars of their era.
Back in the late 40s.
Yes, but their succession in London hadn't been as strong as their succession in some other parts of the country. Right. And so we were invited to sort of be, to come in and sort of bolster that offer and become that succession. Our clients were quite keen for that to happen, because it meant we could carry on delivering some of their projects, and the funders were more happy, and it meant that I didn't have to take the pressures and full responsibility of the whole of cash flowing and that sort of thing. So whether or not it was the right thing to do, who knows, but it's what we did. And so I became a senior partner or member or whatever it is of the Austin Smith Lord LLP. Became the principal, I suppose, of the London office eventually. And my partner did the child rearing part of it for the next few years. So that was just a sort of labour split, really, and worked freelance. So that's the way that we did it. So it's I don't think starting practices got any easier, actually. I think those things, the swings of cash flow and clients needing more and more and more reassurance about the architects that they hire both in terms of financial stability and also technical competence and whether they've done things before and track record, becomes harder and harder, I think. And sort of relates to what we might talk about a bit later in terms of what we're doing at ACOM.
Really. Yeah, absolutely. And and your move then from Austin Smith Lord was directly onto ACOM?
Not at all. I mean, many people who listen to this some people might be aware of, we branched out in Austin Smith Lord into the Middle East, into the UAE, quite successfully for a few years. But we suffered one payment default, I would call it almost force majeure. There was a slowdown of payments in the 2011,
pre-crash or whatever.
Yeah, and there was a slowdown of payments, and we just hadn't been geared quite to take the results of that situation. And the practice went into a CVA.
Company voluntary.
The underlying performance of the business has been very good, strong, and actually we're a classic sort of case to be a CVA. And I'm glad to say that the practice has survived and is still there. But at that time, I and another partner, just after that, once the CVA had been settled, another partner and I both left to pursue other interests. My father had been very ill, yeah. and his own practice was still going, but he was very ill, and I was still a partner in his practice, okay. and it just needed support. So my plan had been actually to go back into the family practice yeah. and use what I'd learnt to rebuild a practice of my own. Okay. Yeah, that was the plan.
And which would have been, I guess, a kind of change in scale again from some of the kind of Middle East work.
Yes, it would. It absolutely would. And, you know, at that point, my children were, you know, that much older. They were starting to get independent and, you know, and so it was, you know, it would have been. And I would, to be honest, it was exactly, I think it was just what I thought I would do. Yeah. And then I received this invitation from ACOM, who have... I've worked with for many years in many different formations, right. and I think it was just a need at the point where the EMEA part of ACOM was getting more and more stronger and stronger and more ambitious, but the lack of an architectural element to balance with the architectural right. elements in the other two regions right. was starting to make it slightly out of kilter. And yeah. so really the proposition was, what if we started architecture in ACOM from underneath yeah. rather than doing the classic thing that other practices have
buying
tried and other businesses yeah. have tried by buying in different architectural brands. What if we do it organically and quietly and sort of from the underneath? And so my role was really to see what already existed, and there already were architects in ACOM in various pieces working in small groups doing, mm. you know, very, very good work. Mm-hmm. And the job was really to... find them, yeah. identify what
to build a team, really.
Yes, to sort of piece in what work out what it was that we could do with a very large organization of very skilled engineers, project managers, cost consultants, yeah. and specialists, yeah. which is broadly what the mix was, and civil engineers, and work out how architecture could start to fit into that comfortably, without disturbing the balance of the. Of the quite delicate ecosystem that is, frankly, is different in Europe yeah. than it is in other parts of the world.
So the bigger parts of the architecture business, you know, the other regions, as it were, then is presumably the Americas and Asia Pacific. Are they the other?
Well, I think we're more or less balanced now, right. but not five years ago. This was years
when
ago.
You joined.
This is 2013.
So it was already within ACOM kind of strong architecture businesses in those regions.
Yes, exactly. So this was a balancing job really, because it was out of kilter. I mean, there are still some parts of ACOM that choose not to have architecture in them because as I said, there's a very delicate ecosystem between the profession and big organisations, and our profession is made broadly of small architects are predominantly SMEs. I know that we think of them as big practices, but you know, compared to engineering firms, they're small organisations, and it would be very easy actually for an organisation like ACOM to build a enormous architectural sort of functional architectural practice that sort of rolls over everything. That's never going to work, and it's not desirable. What we're doing is very gently finding our way in the ecosystem of the profession and the industry to see what gaps exist, where we can support clients because more service or more support or more content or whatever is needed. But a very large part of my role and from the very beginning has been the work with external architectural practices and the architectural supply chain.
Okay.
And
it's interesting then the kind of some of the work in the Middle East, the Al Wakra Stadium being built with Zaha. I mean, that's kind of an interesting partnership there. And
a lot
is delivered...
That's a very early day. That was a very early days partnership then, before architecture, before I arrived. And that's, but we were already in those early days. One of the teams that we did have was a sports specialist architecture team, and so that team had recently been established, and it was so that was a very ambitious combination of an ACOM architecture team and and a external architecture team. And I think it's fair to say all parties learnt a lot of lessons from that. And we learnt an awful lot about the role of the, let's call it the role of the lead designer in the new digital world, because traditionally, and my colleague Dale Sinclair has far more to say on the subject and is currently writing a book on the subject. But as
available
you may know,
in all good bookshops.
Not available at all yet. But what I'm saying is it's a subject that really, really absorbs us. And I think the role of the lead designer traditionally, which is, you know, the duty to coordinate and coordinate all disciplines and provide a fully coordinated design, is being quite distorted by the digital transformation of the profession and the use of 3D tools for that coordination. And I think we're all on a journey with that as to who really has the duty to coordinate and is coordination
where that lead designer is.
Yes, and is coordination a sort of technical functional skill or is it a creative skill actually? Yeah. And where is that?
Is it a project management tool or is it that kind
exactly,
of what's the...
Exactly. Yeah. And I think we're all, mean ACOM, I mean
profession
the profession
generally.
Is on a
learning.
Journey on that. Yeah. And I think we in ACOM are very much in the forefront of that and we've got all sorts of pilots, experiments going on all over the region with different combinations of external architects, internal teams. Where does the lead designer role sit relative to the role of the creative lead?
Yeah. Interested then in, I mean, the kind of profession is really undergoing such, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people about how different the profession was when they started their careers and how different things are now, and the idea of sharing, bringing teams together is within one organisation is kind of one thing, but I guess bringing two different architectural teams together with maybe different cultures or different kind of experiences, I mean, that's quite... I mean, it's just something I don't understand at all, really, as a non-architect. I mean, working... When you build a partnership, maybe with another architecture firm, how does that kind of...
How does it work? Well,
You've had that experience, I guess, both within bringing teams together within one organisation and then...
Yes.
...with other organisations.
Yes, and experiences in the past. I mean, on this subject, I really have to sort of hold out as a bit of a role model, Rod Holmes, who was the lead Grosvenor on Liverpool One, which is the big scheme that Grosvenor did, where he juggled a very large number of architects and a lead master planner architect. And although they weren't all working on the same sites together, those sites did have adjacencies. And I think it's the first time that I'd ever seen somebody sort of put architects together and look at them more than the sum of the parts and sort of put them in teams to talk about how, you know, overall parts of the estate and how they might progress. And there was an unbelievable cast list of architects of whom certainly my little team was very much at the lower end of the spectrum. But for me, it was very influential because I saw that by harnessing our profession and getting them to work together in getting more than one principal in the room. The thing about an architectural practice is it tends to have a small number of principals. And only one of those principals generally participates in any one project, and there are exceptions, but that's a generalisation. Yeah. And therefore, you rarely get three or four principals in a room.
All with
different views and actually debating a topic. And some of the most rewarding situations I've had since is when I've found other architectural principals with other teams who are happy to collaborate and actually really thresh something through and find something that's better than we could have
done individually.
You know, there are some practices out there that I absolutely, you know, have absolutely enjoyed working with, and it's been a really sort of mutually respectful and very fruitful relationship. Yeah. And then there are some practices who just
it's not. I mean, it's by no means a criticism. It just doesn't suit them. They like their practice to lead from the front and not to have any other, you know, other engagement, and that's fine as well. I mean, but going back to my role in AECOM is at least as much finding those teams and partners and placing those teams in AECOM projects as it is building an architecture practice, at least as much, probably more.
Yeah.
So finding those partners and sort of supporting the profession to get them maybe into places where architects wouldn't normally easily end up, like infrastructure is very
important. A big part of, we'll come on to some of the infrastructure in a minute. That's really interesting. And how much then of your time now is spent kind of what you might call designing? I mean, it's a big business you're leading, and there's kind of all the things that go along with that in terms of kind of client liaison and kind of, you know,
depends on your definition of designing.
Well, what's your definition of design? Where do you?
I think about buildings and the projects that we're designing all the time.
Yeah.
Non-stop. I virtually think about nothing else. The design content. I'm certainly not a manager. Therefore, I must be a designer.
Yeah. Okay.
But certainly in the AECOM context, we're here to create a degree of scale, and we're lucky to have attracted some very, very strong principals in this practice who are here to lead their own design work, and it's really, really important that they get to do that, because there has to be a real reason for them being here. It's not this is not a practice that was formed by two or three principals who had a strong design direction. It was formed to serve a very, very wide range of clients in a very, very wide range of sectors. And so the freedom of the of our lead principals to design and then choose their teams and let their teams design is really, really important. So do I design? probably not in our AECOM projects.
And not then, I guess, because of the nature of that work, there isn't really a kind of a house style then to AECOM's work.
There definitely isn't. This is not a stylistically driven practice. No. This is very much a client response driven practice. And we have the unbelievable privilege of working in multidisciplinary teams, and that's probably what makes us different from maybe some of the other engineering big engineering companies that have architecture in their list of services. Yeah. Is that we are actually structured in multidisciplinary teams. So when you look out there on the floor where we're sitting now, you don't know which of those is going to be an architect, which one's going to be a water engineer, which one's going to be there aren't departments.
Okay, you're really integrated in that.
And integration is a really, really hard thing.
Yeah.
I described it to somebody the other day. It's like swimming the channel. You can't get halfway and then go back.
You're either all in
just deconstructed it all and you're all in, and there's just nothing, there's nowhere to go back to.
Yeah.
So it's really, really hard yards for everybody, because I think every discipline is pushing forward the boundaries of their professions in terms of integrated working. And it can be agony. I mean, it can be really hard, but given that, like any business, whether it's a small privately owned business or a massive multinational, you have to make your margins. It may not be called that in small businesses, but you still have to make them. And we're almost sort of inventing machine and driving it. We're inventing a skyrocket and driving it and flying at the same time. It's quite hard.
I mean, I'm really kind of interested there. I guess the kind of public perception of architecture is very much about what they see from outside, you know, looking at a building and the kind of fabric of a building and the kind of even, you know, older buildings about, you know, gargoyles and kind of pillars and columns and things. But a lot of, that's pretty, but not, and maybe that's architecture as well. But the thing that's less talked about in terms of the kind of public perception maybe of architecture is the flow and function and kind of responding to clients' needs for a building. That's, yeah, a lot of the work around, you know, I guess, Crossrail and HS2, and that's more the work that your teams are doing. That is that right? I mean, is that...
Well, I think our teams are doing... It's so broad, they do all, but it's a very interesting point you make, because, of course, public perception, as we know, is shaped mainly by what they're fed.
Yeah.
not wishing to turn it back on you. And of course, architecture being very visual, it's very tempting to judge... To critique
the
and
looks
judge
of something.
It in a way, and people like pictures, and it's an easy
but function
easy
is harder
to
explain.
It's harder to explain. You have to work harder. But I think, you know, we could probably do more in the media and in terms of general public education to talk about the qualities of buildings rather than the looks. And I do think also we've got a rising generation who are much, much more interested in that than the surface. I mean, we can delete this if we need to. On the way to work this morning, I was with my 19-year-old son. And we were... I actually pointed a new building to him, which it was on the Bishop's Avenue. And I said, "What do you think of that?"
Yeah.
And he said, "It just shouldn't be there."
Right.
His words just failed him.
Yeah.
And it wasn't actually to do it. Actually, it was a perfectly well detailed building. I'm not going to say which one it was. And it was one that traditionally, I think, the general public would be considered to be a perfectly acceptable building. But what offended him was the lack of civicness, the lack of of relevance to his generation. And I think that's the point. So I suppose what I'm saying is I think we've got a public and an audience that are open to new ideas, and I think that if we started to talk more about the qualities of buildings and the qualities of our built environment and the quality rather than just the pictures, I think it would probably I actually think it would be well understood and well received, and I think the door is open. So but as far as our teams are concerned, we have teams working in pretty much every sector or at every stage of project.
Right. Okay.
Not just
the kind of infrastructure and the big.
No.
Okay. How big is that? You're obviously a large team in London. How big a part of your EMIA work is the UK business? Are you?
It's about a quarter.
Okay.
It's about evenly split across the four main EMEA regions.
Okay.
So yes, it's probably slightly bigger than a quarter.
So interesting then, just in some of the kind of current projects in the UK.
That people will really know well and probably is most interesting to people is the capacity upgrade of Waterloo Station.
Right.
So working with Weston Williamson, we've got a combined team who have been over the last couple of years joining the Grimshaw's wonderful Eurostar terminal to the main concourse station.
Right, okay.
And back in August, people got the first taste of that when there was something called the blockade.
Yeah.
I don't know where the word comes from. I'm sure I should. Which is where the trains started to come into the network rail trains came into the old
Eurostar platform.
Yes,
exactly. Okay.
That was on a temporary basis so that some of the other platforms could be extended.
Okay.
But the final project, you know, is probably nearly a year away from completion.
Okay.
Not quite, maybe.
You say then an integrated team. So teams working, I mean, in the same office or in the same, kind of coming back again, I guess, to that kind of collaboration.
Yes, absolutely. That particular collaboration, two teams working in the same office together on site. That was very much that that's a that's quite an extreme way of doing it, because that was an absolute, we called it a blended team, where it was very much the best CVs for the job. Because one of the great things about working with another practice is that you get a much wider range of experience to pick from. And so, I mean, a more typical way of working with another team is that you can, that you actually say, you know, that's your bit and that's your bit. I wouldn't say that it's always been easy, but I think that the client has had, I hope everybody agrees, that the outcome has been good. So
I mean, we're doing a lot of work. We're kind of through the festival with Network Rail and their kind of, you know, the stations in the UK now, which used to be, you know, grim places to exist. There's suddenly there's a kind of real renaissance in architectural quality and kind of infrastructure. And okay, so that's one of the big projects you're working on, and then others projects that people would.
My problem is ones that I can actually tell you. That's the problem. Is it's just that we do a lot of FCO work and a lot of defence work. That's the thing. So I think we have.
That's hard to talk about.
So I think there's a lot of our clients come to us for
the quietness
For the quietness, exactly, and that's. Actually, I think that's probably a very good point, to come for the quietness, because we're not. On the one hand, we're an ACOM brand, and we don't necessarily have to talk about every project that we do in order to elevate our brand. But there's no doubt that we get probably more confidential projects than many of our competitors, and that makes it, you know, it makes it hard to.
To talk about the work.
Exactly. We are starting to do. I mean, I can talk about interiors in a minute because that's probably easier. But we are doing some commercial architecture work, you know, for commercial developer clients in London, but there's an area where we're building slowly. It doesn't suit all, you know, it doesn't suit all clients. There's a lot of very good architects in London. And, you know, part of this remit is not necessarily to go in and compete where the profession is already very well represented. We know that there are some some capacity gaps in rail and infrastructure for architecture. Yeah. There aren't really so many capacity gaps
in commercial office buildings, residential. You're not trying to branch out that stage of the business to be a massive kind of commercial office.
It's really kind of specialist
architectural services, really. I guess that's why it's so hard to, you know, when I go and sit in with Ken Shuttleworth or with, you know, Patty Hopkins, or whatever, you know, there's big identifiable projects that they can point to and say, that's what we do. Yeah. And I guess seeing the kind of, it's the process, really, the kind of critical, I mean, I suppose that's why we were coming back to the question, the thing we were talking about earlier, about it being for people to understand what architects often do, apart from buildings, you know, the kind of problem solving and the integrated work with engineers and things. Very hard to explain, actually.
Architecture is not just a product.
It's a service in that sense.
It's a service. It's also a culture. I know, it's many things. So I would say that our starting point for starting architecture at ACOM was focusing on the service, because there are many building typologies and client types out there that need a very, very good architectural service and need it to be done with good design thinkers. That doesn't always have to end in a product that goes in a magazine. And products don't end up on websites and magazines, not only because they're not critically good enough, but because there's lots of reasons.
You can't photograph procedure in that sense.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But I think one of the things that is really worth talking about, though, is going back to the digital transformation, because I think where we're really, really starting to add considerable value across a very broad range of clients, including the London commercial market, is in our
our sort of pushing forward the boundaries of what is possible in, particularly in the later work stages of projects, right, in terms of digital libraries,
yeah,
digital workflow, automation, mm, of certain parts of the process. Yeah. And I think where that's where that I hope will really, really bear fruit, mm, is enabling practices like the one I started,
yeah,
to be able to join the platform, to give them a lot more A, credibility, and B, power to their elbow, yeah, to get their design products out there. And we're talking with quite a large number of smaller practices, of up and coming practices, mm-hmm, who are always going to suffer the same sort of challenges in terms of growing big enough to work at scale.
Yeah.
And start to sort of adopt them onto the Acorn platform, right, where, and that's why I'm talking about the difference between the creative lead and the lead designer,
yeah,
starting to be distinct. Because if you do that, yeah, that certainly doesn't mean, mm, that the creative lead doesn't have to understand how to make a building.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah,
that's absolutely, that is fundamental.
Yeah.
And it certainly doesn't mean that the lead designer and the leader of the digital platform, and because that
which the creativity,
just,
yeah,
doesn't understand absolutely what good design looks,
yeah,
like. But I think the ability, and I think, I often make the analogy, and maybe it's relevant here, is particularly when talking about brands, nobody ever confuses Sony with the artists on their label.
No.
They actually have two different jobs.
Yeah.
They're both very big brands.
Yeah.
You know, but the band and Sony,
yeah,
or the band and the label are always, yeah, big brands,
yeah,
but nobody confuses the two.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good analogy for what we're doing, because, you know, generally, the band or the,
yeah,
artist is not going out there doing their own promoting,
no,
doing all,
no,
their own,
no,
doing all their own production,
no,
all of that sort of stuff. Generally, I know things,
yeah,
are changing.
Things
are,
well, that's
now,
interesting.
Things
again, for other professions, are,
yeah,
how the kind of digital revolution, yeah, is perhaps changing.
Yeah,
the,
that's right.
I'm interested,
that's
then, in how the kind of recruitment into firms. You see some people who want to work for, I mean, they're kind of to be a name, maybe,
mm,
themselves. And would you think you attract a different, I'm wondering at what stage in a kind of university career, maybe, or training career, people think, actually, I'm interested in that kind of service delivery rather than...
Oh, no,
do
don't make
that?
The mistake of thinking that people don't come here to design. We've got some fabulous designers here.
I'm kind of suggesting...
I think we attract people who have had an education that really that make them interested in the multidisciplinary aspects,
okay,
of design. So,
because there are clearly some people who want to see, at the end of the day, a kind of kind of to be validated by seeing
a building with their own particular specific
in Wallpaper
name
magazine or in Design,
yeah,
or something,
yeah,
like that.
I genuinely think that over the next few years you will see those individuals,
right,
emerging off the Acorn platform,
yeah,
as well as small design houses that are attached to Acorn,
yeah,
also, you know, in the same way. I think you'll see both. I think you can do it either way,
yeah.
And I think sometimes it depends which sector you work in, because, so for example, something like healthcare,
mm,
a healthcare architect, it's very, very difficult to kind of go out on your own and sort of develop,
yeah,
your own name and get your own name on the,
yeah,
tin.
Yeah.
Residential and commercial schemes, possibly,
mm,
slightly easier.
Yeah.
I think it depends. It depends what part of the profession and what sector and what type of buildings that you want to work on.
Yeah.
But I think the people that we attract are interested in the multidisciplinary,
yeah,
endeavour,
yeah,
and the fact that it's quite cutting edge, not just technically but organisationally.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, we're putting a man on the moon here.
Mm. Does that siloed approach maybe to kind of architectural education? I mean, engineers are trained, you know, by schools of engineering, and architects,
mm,
are trained by schools of architecture. You know, is there a kind of... And so you're talking about kind of integration and about kind of collaboration.
I think it does naturally gravitate us towards finding graduates from those institutions who are taking a more multidisciplinary approach. Okay. For example, Reading's recently opened a School of Architecture.
Right. Okay. So I mean, people like Dale Sinclair as really taking on those kind of thought leadership, kind of future thinking, and it's kind of interesting your thoughts about where the profession's going, maybe for where London's going, for, you know, kind of future direction. Have you must be thinking about the future of the business and the future of the sector. What do you see AECOM doing in EMEA, EMIA in?
Well, there's the profession and then there's AECOM.
Yeah.
And then there's the
well,
industry.
There's two.
I think the profession. I think the profession will go from strength to strength as people start to understand that the future of it is in the brain and not the grunt.
Yeah.
So for so long, you know, I think of what I did in my dad's practice. So little of it was the thinking compared to, not that he didn't do thinking, but so little of it was the thinking compared to the getting out the rote rings and actually producing the stuff. And I just think that with the increasing abilities of everybody to code and script and find the things that used to be laborious and be production being taken out of the
kind of grunt work of it's interesting. I was talking to we had Ben Derbyshire on the program a couple of few weeks ago, talking about kind of male and female approaches maybe to problem solving, and whether architecture is a predominantly certainly kind of male or seen as a male dominated industry, as perhaps practices using more kind of male approaches to problem solving, so just grunt work or kind of brute force approaches to, you know, let's just work all night because we're macho and because we'll just be able to, you know, just do lots. Do you think there's a male female difference there, or is that just a?
That's really hard.
Because there is certainly a workload thing, isn't there, within architecture, do you think? I mean, do you think
the digital revolution, in theory, should be able to help those who are afflicted with that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's so male and female. I think there are just various different ways of thinking, and you need all those schools of thought.
Yeah.
Maybe they are polarized a little bit towards maleness and femaleness, but I think, I don't know. I think the people that are attracted into architecture are pretty broad church anyway. I don't think you get those extremes of sort of, I don't know. Somehow, I don't know.
That's interesting.
Sure. I don't see that. I have male and female architectural leaders who cover both of those spectrums.
Okay.
So I don't think
maybe you're just leading a more diverse.
I don't think gender is the that respect is the in the context is the dividing factor.
Okay.
But I do think there are different ways of working, and I think those of them, male or female, who are prepared to kind of get on the bus to working smarter, are going to be the
ones to succeed.
Future of the profession.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think there's a one of the things that I'm very interested in is the is in the definition of creative industry, because architecture is a creative industry in most of the variously accepted definitions, and that means that there's quite a lot of sunk work generally to get to a creative solution. Now, if you look at it in the context of the industry is generally run on resource planning, which means you put in an hour and you get a result from that hour.
Yeah.
So I think the industry finds it very hard to accommodate architecture on the a creative industry on that platform, because it represents it's seen to represent uncertainty and risk. So I think that the architects who can who can work smarter and actually keep their iterative design abilities, but still create more certainty about when an outcome might happen or what it might be.
It's a very
delicate balance, but I think that's the heart of it. And I think it's the smart working, and I don't think that's a male or a female disposition. No. Certainly okay. not across no. the cohort of architects.
No. Okay, Winnie, I need to start just kind of rounding up then. Just interested in talking a lot, obviously, London Professor of Architecture, and kind of interested in people's grow up in London, people's. Kind of my standard question, really. Kind of what inspires people in London? What troubles people in London? You've seen lots of cities in your work across ACOM, but and still choosing, presumably leading such a large team, could choose to live, work from any of those offices. So still chosen London as a place to live and as a kind of hub for. We like to see London as a kind of real global hub for perhaps. Unparalleled in terms of its level of creativity and talent pool in London. Just kind of interested in your kind of thoughts, reflections on London as a city for architects and architecture.
Well, I do think it's the best city in the world for that, and that's why I choose to live here. And I say I'm lucky to have the rights to live and work in other places. So it is a very definite choice. Of course I'm going to mention housing because nobody could not mention housing in this context. I am alarmed by the fact that it will be absolutely impossible for my children's generation to settle and feel settled in London. I think we've got to use the rest of the country it's very dangerous to talk about London, think of it as having a boundary. The UK is a fantastic place. Yeah. And the better our infrastructure gets, the more you can start to get the benefits of London without necessarily having to spend your entire life struggling to rent or own something in the London market, because I think it's a waste of a life. I don't want my children to spend their whole lives struggling
to get on a property ladder
or spend their whole lives paying rent as such a high proportion of their incomes. My even if they were lawyers and accountants or whatever the highest, I don't know what the highest paid professionals are generally, but
even then
it's not easy. And I'm not talking about my children in particular. I want that generation to have choice, and I want them to be pursuing the things they want to do. Those things are available to them in London, but it's not possible for them to live there. So one of the things that we can do is make the infrastructure to other parts of the country so much better, because we've got parts of the country that need that kind of energy. And I mean, for example, I've recently sort of half moved to a part of the country that would really shock people. I've moved to Newquay.
Wow. Okay.
Gritty.
Yeah.
Exciting. Yeah. Topographically amazing. Yeah. 35 minutes into Gatwick on the plane. This is doable stuff. This is what infrastructure is about.
Yeah.
And I think that we just need to think bigger about London. I think it's a region, it's a country, it's not just a place within the boundaries of the London boroughs. So I think that needs to be teamed with all the radical thinking that's being done about housing in London, so people actually have a choice, because at the moment there's just no choice. Yeah. There's nowhere to go.
No, that's really Greater London thinking, isn't it?
Greater London needs to be greater, and we still need to pay all the attention that everybody's talking about London itself.
Yeah.
But get people in and out easier, happier, quicker, with more comfortable lives and reasonable home lives where kids can have where there is space and there are schools.
Yeah, fantastic.
That's my take on it.
You've been listening to Architecture Masters, the podcast from the London Festival of Architecture. On the programme this week was Jennifer Dixon. You can find out more about Jennifer and her work at architecturemasters.org, from where you can also subscribe to the programme and follow us on Twitter. If you've enjoyed the programme, we'd be grateful if you'd leave a review or a rating with your podcast provider, as this helps others to discover the programme. You can send any comments, questions or suggestions by email to hello@architecturemasters.org. I'm Owen Wainhouse. Thank you for listening.